Okay, well, good morning and welcome to this, the final plenary session of this year's symposium. We've delayed the start because, of course, the panels were due to finish at 11 but went on, and you need time to come from one building to another. I'm very pleased to introduce our final speaker here for this symposium. Professor Alexis Heraklidis is a professor of international relations and conflict analysis at the Pandion University Department of Political Science and History. He's well known, I'm sure, to all of you. He has had a very diverse career for international relations. He's held the post of Counselor for Minorities and Human Rights at the Greek Foreign Ministry. Between 1983 and 1997. In that capacity, he's participated in a number of intergovernmental conferences and meetings, notably in the context of the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe, as well as the United Nations, the European Community, the Council of Europe, and he was also appointed as an alternate expert of the United Nations Subcommission on Prevention of Discrimination and the Protection of Minorities. Alexis gained his first degree from the Pandion School, but then his master's in London, sadly not at the LSE, but at UCL, which we'll just forgive him. And then he went to do his PhD at the University of Kent, at each stage with notable professors in his field. I'm sure you know that he has published very widely on secessionist conflicts, self-determination, external involvement in separatist wars, the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe, and then specific conflicts from different parts of the world, but in particular on Kosovo, on the southern Sudan, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And from 1996 onwards, his main research concerns have been the Cyprus question, the Greek-Turkish conflict, and images and perceptions in Greek foreign policy. Now, you can see the arrangement of the chairs here. We are emulating some kind of TV chat show, I think. And like most TV chat show guests, Alexis has a book to sell. That is, last year, in fairness, he published his latest book, which was The Greek-Turkish Conflict in the Aegean, Imagined Enemies, with Palgrave here in the UK. Now, the title for his presentation here is Greek-Turkish Relations, Rivalry, Détente, or Reconciliation. I should say that we've been honoured to have Alexis with us as one of our research fellows, senior fellows, here in the Hellenic Observatory this year. So it is an opportunity also to say thank you for your participation in the observatory. We now look forward to your presentation, and I know that Alexis has agreed to allow plenty of time for questions and answers. So please, Alexis, thank you very much.
To begin with, thank you very much for your kind words and for the invitation. I will address four questions. One would be, I'll begin with a historical record of Greek-Turkish relations and refer to the initial reconciliation of the 1930s. Then I will present the present situation, which I regard as a case of détente rather than reconciliation, the last 12 years, that is. Then I will present the main obstacles to reconciliation that have not allowed the détente to... that's not helpful. It creates a barrier between me and... And the fourth would be to look, and that's where the book comes in to some extent. I'll refer to the main bilateral bone of contention between Greece and Turkey, which is the Aegean conflict, but some basic elements with regard to the Aegean and why it's not resolved. But before I proceed further, let me do something which is done in any PhD definitions. So, and another little thing, of course, is that definitions must be very much present in the first chapter of a PhD, but they must disappear if the PhD is good enough to be published as a book. So that's one part that has to be taken out. Otherwise, it's very stodgy and so on and uninspiring. Now, by rivalry, I mean a level of antagonism ranging from armed conflict to recurring crisis and, at best, an unstable no-war situation. By reconciliation, these are simple working definitions, so we will understand each other, basically. By reconciliation, I imply a historical compromise in which most or all of the outstanding differences between the two sides have been resolved. What I imply here, to remember my professor at University College London. At the time, University College London, which was much forward-looking than LSE. LSE was doing simply diplomatic history under Northage. So I was lucky to be in University College London and under John Burton, the father of conflict resolution. Now, I imply reconciliation as conflict resolution rather than merely conflict settlement, which may prove ephemeral. And I use détente in the sense of the rivalry continuing, but put within reasonable bounds. The outstanding problems have not been resolved, but the dialogue continues, this effective conflict prevention, conflict management, and so on. You know, the word détente, of course, comes from détente between East and West, as you probably know. Now, let us go now and let us see what the record has to say as regards Greek-Turkish relations. Difficulty there is, when do Greek-Turkish relations start? Some would say from the Greek War of Independence. Others would go to the period 1919-22. But I've put it a bit, I've confined it to the moment when the two nation states were independent, that is Turkey, from 1923 onwards. So what I'm implying is, what is the record from the Lausanne Treaty until today? In my book, I actually start from 1912, which I considered the coup de pioche of Greek-Turkish relations, when the Greek-Turkish relations, it was the point of no return as regards the class. But there's a problem there that Turkey was not Turkey, but the Ottoman Empire, and the Turks defined themselves not as Turks, but as Ottomans. So that's why, technically, it's perhaps better to start with 23. And that's what is done by most textbooks on Greek-Turkish relations, although there's reference, of course, to the past. Now, if one looks at that, one sees periods of rivalry, periods of reconciliation, and so on. And I won't go into the mathematics of it, but it ends up with more or less the following: 42 years of rivalry, as defined previously, 19 years of rapprochement, and 20 years of détente. So if one adds the rapprochement to the 20 years of détente, one has roughly 42 years of rivalry, 39 of détente, which is not a bad harvest. Which is not a meager harvest by the standards of an ongoing rivalry, as I see it. Now, let us start with reconciliation. Reconciliation is the period 1930 to 1954. In fact, autumn 1954, when the Cyprus conflict came to the fore as an open clash between Greece and Turkey in the United Nations General Assembly. And that was the death knell of the reconciliation. 1930 is the date when the word friendship was also used, as pointed out by my former student Leonidas Karakatsanis in panel one. And as he says, this created a grammar of friendship, to use more sophisticated jargon. At the time, if one looks at that period, there was talk, or even talk, of a Greek-Turkish confederation, Kemal had again and again said that the Greek-Turkish friendship is eternal, and I think it was his foreign minister, Arash, Rushdu Arash, who said that the boundaries between the two states are meaningless. What did the trick in those days? What are the fundamentals that existed then that made this historical compromise possible after the devastating clash between the two parties from 1919 and the eviction of 2 million human beings, which was the most massive exchange of populations until then? That was before the India-Pakistan case. It's quite astounding after this dramatic events to be able to reach such an agreement. Of course, obviously, there's the astuteness on the part of Venizelos and his recipients, Kemal Inonu and Foreign Minister Rushdu Arash. But there were structural reasons involved as well, as far from the agency factor, if you want. One was that both sides were clearly status quo states. They had no ambitions with regard to the territory of the other side. The ambitions that existed referred to other parts, to other territories. In the case of Greece, it was southern Albania and the Dodecanese, which were not Turkish territories. And as far as Turkey was concerned, on the basis of its national pact, the Misak İmirli, they wanted to have the Alexandretta region, and they did after a plebiscite, which is arguably not a very mock plebiscite, perhaps. But in any event, that was taken, and that was Hatay, that was the region. So as regards the two sides, they were status quo powers as far as their borders were concerned. A second factor is that Cyprus was looming somewhere looming in the air. It was there, but it was not allowed to rock the boat. The rumblings of the Cyprus volcano, since I have Iceland now in my mind, were there. But both Kemal and Venizelos were able to withstand the calls of the Greek Cypriots and, to a lesser extent, the Turkish Cypriots for assistance and so on. And so there was no point, and there was no friction as regards Cyprus, although there was the date 1931 when there was an uprising, but that was kept within bounds again. The third factor, which is missing now, at least as far as Greece is concerned, is the external threat. Both sides felt threatened by revisionist Italy. You know, the concept of Italy as wanting to become dominant in the Mediterranean, the Mare Nostrum concept, and Italy was very much present in the Aegean and the Dodecanese islands. And it was not only Italy, which was very much present in the region, but also another revisionist country, Bulgaria, which was feeling the sting of the Neuilly Peace Treaty. And as regards the period after 1945, of course, Greece was embroiled in its civil war and so on, but again, there was a common threat from the Soviet Union and the communist bloc that brought the two parties together, and they joined hand in hand in NATO at the very same date, if I'm not mistaken. Now, as regards détente, I'm moving from the reconciliation to détente. Détente is the present state of affairs. This was my position when this thing came about. A number of other colleagues, particularly on the eastern side of the Aegean in Turkey, spoke in their articles of reconciliation, rapprochement. I was more pessimistic, and I used the word détente ever since. Détente, to my mind, is the realistic option. It follows the more or less kind of neo-functionalist approach in the sense of low politics, enhanced cooperation, tourism, and so on. It's something that was already pointed out by a number of researchers back in the late 80s and 90s, including one named Haas, not Richard Haas, but not Ernest Haas, but Richard Haas. It has double S and double A. And he was talking about low politics being the only possibility and the only way to move forward, because the high politics differences that exist, the Aegean and so on, are very difficult to resolve. Now, the détente idea, this low politics approach, was first conceived by Turgut Özal, the charismatic Turkish prime minister and later president in the 80s and early 90s. And for a moment, he was able to convince Andreas Papandreou in their famous Davos meeting of late January 1988. The expectation here is that after decades of economic cooperation and low politics, the outstanding bilateral issues will be de-securitized and become more amenable to a settlement. Another aspect of détente is that on the basis of this détente, there is a conscious attempt to prevent crisis and so on in the Aegean and elsewhere. And in the last 20 years, there were a number of difficulties and frictions and so on in the Aegean in particular, which did not get out of hand as a result of deliberate policy by both sides. Now, skeptics of this détente approach, that it's the only way forward and so on, point out that economic cooperation, although it's quite impressive, is still in its early stages, by the standards of neighboring states, that is, and that it's highly improbable whether economic cooperation on its own can function as a safety net if there is a nationalist frenzy on either side of the Aegean, a change of government. I mean, it would be quite, in the Greek case, a change of government to Antonis Samaras, the people around him are supporting friendship with Israel and bad relations with Turkey would be quite a dramatic shift, and there would be antagonism and brickmanship and so on. Now, economic cooperation and so on would not be able to withstand this. Although some economic magnates that I've talked to, businessmen, are more optimistic that they can do the trick and be able to convince even Jingoist Samaras, if he was in government, not to play havoc with Greek-Turkish relations, although I am not convinced. Furthermore, economic cooperation as such something that I don't really understand. It was my economics are my weak point, is that economics can also be antagonistic in various areas. For example, energy cooperation that appears as one way of, institutionalizing and so on Greek-Turkish relations, but on the other hand, it could be also conflictual. In other words, economic cooperation is not by definition always smooth. Now let's try and look into the basic reasons why reconciliation has not come about. If I may permit it to do the following, again, looking at the matter from the point d'appui of a doctorate dissertation, review of the literature, fundamental, of course. A review of the literature would come up with at least 12 reasons that do not permit a reconciliation on the model of the 1930s and early 50s. Obviously, one obvious candidate is the intractable Cyprus problem, which always is counted to poison Greek-Turkish relations. Secondly, this is a review of the literature, as I said. The sheer intractability of the Greek-Turkish conflict is in particular the Aegean dispute, which is seen as intractable. The perception of all the differences, be it the Aegean or others, in zero-sum win-lose terms. The mutual threat perceptions and related security dilemma. The mutual lack of trust and the tendency, there's an overlap, of course, with this, as you'll probably notice. The mutual lack of trust and the tendency to follow a worst-case scenario in Greek-Turkish relations. The predominance of enemy imagery, reinforced by selective reporting in the media, the political socialization in the schools, textbooks, and so on, anniversaries, commemorations, parades, etc. The domestic factor. The two publics in the majority regard the other side as the enemy and the main threat. and regard any settlement as a sellout on national issues. The concept of national issues exists in both Greece and Turkey. In Turkey, it's mili dava, ethnika themata in Greek. Now, another, the eighth reason is weak governments and political leaders, which are either nationalistic or have irresponsibly fanned the flames of animosity. Nine, the long history of the rivalry that suggests antagonism and animosity as the rule, and the way out as unrealistic. Something else that comes from the literature, particularly from the even journalists and so on, is who have written books, is uncontrollable passions that do not permit a rational costing of the conflict that would lead to a settlement to the benefit of both parties. The 11, the great influence of nationalism, spearheaded by nationalists and other hardliners that oppose any reconciliation and are successful spoilers whenever meaningful talks are underway. 12, securitization. Most of all, the destructive role of those who have invested in the conflict and managed to portray themselves as the saviors of the respective nation states. Clearly, all these factors taken together create an awesome barrier against burying the hatchet. In fact, if one looks at each one of them more closely, there have been conscious attempts to overcome them, and I'll just mention some examples. The Cyprus question, of course, has been there and has sounded the death knell of Greek-Turkish relations. But obviously, the resolution of the conflict would spur reconciliation in Greece and so on. But this is something that the Greece and Turkey, it's not for them to resolve the conflict. They can be helpful. They can put pressure on the two communities in Cyprus, but it's not for the two motherlands, if I may put it that way, to impose a settlement. You know, the Zurich Agreement comes to mind, the Zurich-London Agreement, an imposed settlement. This is not effective. Obviously, what one should do here is what is known as decoupling. So you decouple the resolution of the Cyprus problem from the Greek-Turkish relations. It's a difficult process, but it's something that has been tried by various Greek governments, including the totally incompetent government of Kostas Karamanlis. In this regard, there was a conscious attempt to decouple. It didn't bear fruit, but still, there was a deliberate attempt to do so. As regards the, I won't go through all 12 of them, you know, to save time. As regards the intractability of the Aegean conflict and so on, now there, there have been two instances where the two parties went into detailed, had a detailed dialogue and give and take and so on, and they arrived at a number of fundamental principles which could, on the basis of which a resolution could come about, which would have been, I would say, more positive sum rather than zero sum, or zero sum in the sense of splitting the difference in the very middle. So why these two attempts did not bear fruit will be my last presentation, so my fourth, so I won't go into details as regards to that. Now, with regard to the zero-sum factor and so on, perceptions and so on, there have been attempts to change school books. There have been various organizations at this civil society level and so on. And it is a fact that at least to some extent, starting with the Mitsotakis government in 1990, for a while, and particularly when Papa Konstantinou was foreign minister, and again from the Simitis government when Greece was fortunate enough to not to have Pangalos as foreign minister, then there was a conscious attempt to, you know, put nationalism, frenzy, and so on the margins. The domestic factor is a well-known impediment, but when Karamanlis, Konstantinos Karamanlis, the Karamanlis worth remembering, Konstantinos Karamanlis as Prime Minister, consciously put that aside and tried to have a dialogue with his Turkish counterparts on the basis of mutual respect and so on. Turgut Özal did it, Kostas Simitis, Ismail Cem, Erdogan to some extent, Gül and so on, and recently there has been some movement in this regard, a conscious effort to deal somewhat with the domestic factor, which is a basic and fundamental reason. Now, as to, there's another reason which is often comes forward, it's the first, and I deal with it in the first chapters of my book, it's the image, the perception that the conflict is primordial, perennial. It has been there for at least 1,000 years, from the Battle of Manzikert and so on. This is totally unrealistic. I mean, these two people were religious groups and mixed and multinational empires and so on, so there was no idea of two ethnic groups or two national groups. I think the point of no return is 1912, but irrespective of that, the long history ideal is inbuilt in the school books and so on. And I found it very interesting whenever I am in Turkey and, you know, speak with either students or people who are not really, you know, scientists or so, or scholars, they would come up with, well, we had our empire, you had your empire. The Byzantine Empire is regarded as a Greek empire, as it is by most Greeks because of the school books. Although it was not a Greek empire, but a multinational empire, which after a point used the Greek language. But I will leave aside this anachronistic thing and go on to something which I find a bit more amusing. It's a view pointed out by Henry Kissinger, who I don't have any particular respect for his views, be it in academia and so on. But he comes out with the following interesting thing, that the two sides defy rationality. This is a situation of extreme passion and so on, and it cannot be dealt with rational means. I mean, this might be the case to some extent, but we can have the very opposite, as seen with the seismic diplomacy and so on. The emotional thing could be the other way as well. It could be positive on either side. And nationalism and the war party and so on can have also been dealt with to some extent by responsible leadership and by the civic society. Despite the attempts to try to put a lid to control these factors, the conflict continues. My thesis, and if I would, put it as a, you mentioned Kevin yesterday, research hypotheses, which are fundamental to a doctorate. My research hypothesis, which needs to be substantiated more than I've done in my book, I must be critical of that, I could have been more concrete in that regard, is the following. The basic reason why these 12 reasons have not been overcome and there has not been reconciliation until now. It's that the Greek-Turkish differences have not been resolved and there has not been a mutually beneficial outcome because the differences are but the tip of the iceberg. They are offshoots of something far deeper and far more difficult to dislodge, let alone deal with it in a rational way. It is the weight of history, mainly imagined history, based on chosen glories and traumas. Needless to say, that's not that I, something that I've come up with. It's the main contributors here are Hercule Milas and Vamik Volkan. I have basically followed their logic and looked at it in the Aegean and Cyprus. And the second element, which is related to the narratives, is the chosen collective identities, which are built on slighting and demonizing the other side. And again, going back to the original, the working hypothesis is that this is the crux of the antagonism, and less the tangible disputes as such, even though they involve important issues such as sovereign rights and so on, oil, etc. Now, 5 minutes or not?
Certainly.
I would like to address the Aegean conflict in a succinct manner to give you the basic flavor of the Aegean conflict and why it has not been resolved. Now, I will approach this in, let me see, three ways of approaching it, through sort of attack the conflict through three strategies. One is the more traditional one, which would look at the substantive differences and the procedural differences. Now, as regards the procedural differences, they are basically the following. One side, the Greek side, whose argumentation is basically that of international lawyers, is that the conflict can be resolved in an international legal forum, that is what is called adjudication. And the ideal adjudication forum is the International Court of Justice. But they add one more element, some international lawyers of the, let's say, the more hawkish international lawyers in Greece, the hardliners. And this is the official position in Greece if you look at WWMFAGR, the site of the Greek foreign minister, is that there's only one issue to resolve, the continental shelf. Now, as you realize, this a la carte approach is, you know, considered totally unacceptable by Turkey. By the way, the Aegean conflict is comprised of no less than 7 distinct conflicts. And all the articles and books written by Greeks and Turks, and most of them are, you know, they act as ambassadors of their side, do accept that the conflict exists bring out the arguments of either side. But the official position of Greece, at least, it's basically seen as a initial negotiating position, is that it's only one conflict, the continental shelf, and one remedy, one procedure as a remedy, the Hague Court. Of course, as you would expect, Turkey totally does not accept that, and it says that it's totally illogical, and this is very much, it's not a constructive attitude to move in that direction. And I think that they have a point there. Now, as regards substance, another thing that is worth mentioning, and something that I found very interesting, if you look carefully at what the Turks have been saying about adjudication, there are at various phases of the conflict, be it in the late 70s, again in the mid 90s, and so on, they have implied that they're not totally adverse to going to The Hague. In a very interesting meeting, it was in Montreux, Ejevit. No, it wasn't in Montreux, it was after Montreux, but it was on the basis of discussion of Karamanlis and Ejevit. Ejevit, in an informal meeting, told his Greek interlocutor, who was sent there by Karamanlis, that, well, we are not adverse to going to The Hague, but The Hague must not act as a Russian roulette. So we must be well prepared and so on. It must not, something unexpected should not come out of it. I mean, it should be, and, you know, it should be an outcome that would be acceptable to both sides. That was, I think, he was implying. Now, another thing that I found out, and it's still very much present, perhaps to a lesser extent than previously, is that Turkish academics and even international lawyers regard the Hague Court, the International Court of Justice, as by definition biased towards Greece, because Greece has a better reputation until recently, of course. Because now I would think there would be more open mind with Greeks having not so. But who knows? The thing is that they think that, you know, there's the international lawyers, many of whom are Europeans and Americans and so on, we regard Turkey as the terrible Turk and so on. They have this thing is ingrained in their thinking, but it's difficult to find data on it, but if you speak informally to Turkish ambassadors and lawyers, they would accept that. Now, as regards substance, the basic difficulties with regard to substance are the following, and I base this on interviews, among others, with a recent interview I had with Kostas Simitis, who's kind enough to see me, and his chief advisor on the Aegean, which is Professor Rosakis. Now, the basic problem, and it's something that I knew already, of course, before meeting him, but just substantiated, I affirmed it, is that the 10 miles of airspace. I mean, Greece is in the unorthodox situation and the very difficult situation of being the only country in the world that has an airspace which is wider than the territorial waters. But if the airspace is to align itself with the territorial waters, imagine the outcry in Greece: this is a sellout, this is the our sovereignty is being what would be the word, not redrawing of the sovereignty, but the sovereignty goes back. What would be the word?
Retreat
of the sense. So I mean part of Greek sovereignty is being thrown away. And then the problem, another problem, again substantial, is the territorial waters. Now, the view dominant until recently among the hardliners, international lawyers and diplomats, was that because of the law of the sea, which clearly says that the miles could be up to 12, Greece can do it unilaterally. If you look at all the textbooks and all the articles by serious specialists on maritime law, etc., they end up with the following, which comes out also from the treaties, that when you have a country on the opposite side, you cannot do something unilaterally, you must do it after due consultation. I mean, obviously, if you do something which is against the interests of the other side, that this is an unfriendly act. Then there's also the delimitation of the continental shelf. The view that has dominated the scene, particularly from Andreas Papandreou onwards, is that somehow the Aegean is... all the continental shelf of the Aegean should be Greek. In fact, if you go to the International Court of Justice, and I can assure you that I've checked this out with a number of international lawyers, and I've got some inside information as well from the ongoing dialogue, which has started in 2002 and continues and has been invigorated in the last 6 months or a year, the outcome in an International Court of Justice would be 75-25 or 70-30. And even that, the 30 or the 25, would be totally unacceptable to the Greek public, which has this high expectation that the whole of the Aegean is basically a Greek sea or Greek lake. Now, as regards Turkey, there are a number of difficulties which Turkey has. For example, the territorial sea, there could be a partial extension of the territorial sea in some areas, so long as it doesn't completely make the open sea disappear in the Aegean and so on. There's also the question of abandoning the gray zones, but I'm going into technicalities which might put you into difficulty, so let me conclude rather than go into the details. We could do that in the discussion. Another little thing, now there's one thing that I want to mention. Again, it goes back to the discussion of Ecevit with this ambassador when he told him about the Russian roulette. Now, Ecevit, who in the Greek mind is considered the awful, the ogre, and so on, and because of 1974 Cyprus, was much more open to dialogue than Demirel in those days. And he, being a very clever and intellectual and so on, he was able to grasp all the minute details of the Aegean conflict. And he mentioned to this ambassador that, look, one of the difficulties of one of the seven is the question of demilitarization. He said that, well, we're not happy with it, and we think that it serves no purpose, for we are not threatening Greece, contrary to what Greece feels and is convinced that we're threatening, etc. And we would be prepared to accept a level of demilitarization so long as it serves Greece's security concerns, and he used that, the English term. It's quite interesting as a concept. Now, let me conclude. My overall stance after having studied, I started studying the Aegean. I didn't know I knew very few things about the Aegean until 1996, until that crisis. I was dealing with things further afar, and one can have a greater distance. By the way, another little thing. I don't want to put you in a difficult position, but if I had a Greek student, the first things I would have told him if he does a PhD is do nothing with Greece. Your subject should not be Greek. You can do Greece afterwards. Do something else. You will have it. But now it's too late because both all of you have done Greece, so it's too late. In any event, even if one does not do it in his PhD, if he's a Greek, he gets trapped. And that's my case, and one gets involved with a Greek subject. And from then onwards, one finds, first of all, the domestic factor being very crucial, the sellout on national issues, the exaggerated expectations of both publics, and in particular of the Greek public, as regards a solution to the Aegean. And since the expectations are very high, any kind of solution, which will obviously be a compromise, will be difficult to swallow. And basically, there is the crux of the problem again. The basic issue is the respective angst of both parties. On the one side, as far as the Aegean in particular is concerned, is the fear that Greece wants to make the Aegean a Greek lake. On the Turkish side, that's that fear. And on the Turkish and on the Greek side, you can see that in MFAGR, in the Greek side, it is that Turkey wants to get half of the continental shelf of the Aegean, and in that sense encircle the Greek islands in the eastern Aegean, and at a later stage be able to take them over to the word I found in the Greek site is ensnare, as if it's a rabbit or something, and grab the eastern Greek islands. On the Turkish side, it's the Greek lake which will suffocate Turkey. But if one looks a bit deeper, you know, as I said, the tip of the iceberg, one comes out with the following. In the Greek, as regards Greece, in particular, Davutoglu has played the role in recent years, is the specter of neo-Ottomanism and expansionism on the part of the Turks. And not only the Greek islands are under threat, but the whole of Cyprus and Greek Thrace. Now, as far as the Turks are concerned, it's a kind of mirror image here. They regard Greece as still in the throes of irredentism, of the Megali Idea. I have just recently I've translated a Turkish book by a leftist scholar in Ankara University. And in her introduction to the Greek public, she goes into class and asks her students, what do you know about Greece? Name three cities, something of Greek culture. And the only thing that they know is the Megali Idea. You see, they only know the great idea, the irredentism of Greece, nothing else. They just know the capital, Athens, and that's it. Now, Megali Idea has reappeared, has come to the fore again. And they give us example Cyprus, which they regard as part of the Megali Idea. And they, according to the dominant view, at least in the diplomatic circles until recently, the avowed aim of Greece, of course, is not a frontal attack like in 1919, what is called, they use the term occupation and invasion, while in Cyprus we say invasion and occupation. Now they say occupation of Smyrna and invasion. It's the same, the very same term, but the other way around. And they say that now the strategy of Greece is legalistic. It's a piecemeal approach, a salami tactic, if you want. It is, first of all, you have the territorial waters in 3 miles. Then the airspace becomes 10 miles in 1931, 1 year after the rapprochement. Then the territorial waters become from 3 to 6. Turkey sticks to the 3 miles from 1923, from Lausanne. Then you have the militarization, And then you want to have the whole of the continental shelf of the Aegean as Greek. So Greece is gradually moving and getting the whole of the Aegean, and in Greece has actually doubled its territory in the Aegean. In a very interesting book written by two friends of mine, Osgirim Lee and Sophos, about the, it's the torment of history or something like that title. Do you remember? Yeah, tormented by history. I found a useful a chapter somewhere towards the end, which talks in terms of the Aegean being the new narrative and discourse of Greece, since Greece could not move further up in Macedonia. Greece is a quintessential Aegean country. The islands and so on. There is an element of course, that's obvious, but and the fact that the islands, the great majority of islands are Greek, and Greece regards itself as a maritime country and so on. You know, one can understand the sensitivity of Greece as far as this is concerned. Now I'll conclude with the following, which is basically taken from Milas and Volcan. I have my own wording. It's not a question of plagiarism, may I assure you. So it's something to be careful with PhDs. The other side, one needs the other side as threatening as and as the enemy. I could go into more detail as far as this is in this regard, because I didn't develop it very much in a while. But it seems, as in the Palestinian-Israeli case, that there are positive functions to be found along the Simmel-Koser postulate. External threat breeds internal cohesion. A state of antagonism has positive functions not only for warmongers who invest in the conflict, but also for the two peoples and their leaders. If the enemy is no more, the two states may find themselves with a host of unsurmountable internal divisions and domestic problems. This is something that Smucha, who is one of the best-known political scientists in Israel, has talked about in the case of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And I would conclude with, in this case, what comes to mind is, of course, Kavafis' well-known now what will become of us, this is of course in another context, his verse, now what will become of us without barbarians? These people were a kind of solution. So I think this is the basic reason why the two sides have not resolved the conflict. On the other hand, in the discussion that we'll have, I'll refer also to some of the things that have come out with another valuable source that we have, students and academics alike, the wiki. I found very useful things in there. We could discuss that and link it with the economic situation as well. Thanks very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Alexei, very much indeed. There was so much of that, so many different dimensions. I don't know whether you're more comfortable here or there.
Yeah, I'll probably sit there. Yeah.
We'll certainly jump for discussion in a moment. Let me perhaps just try to kick off. I thought the presentation, of course, was excellent to it with its different dimensions and so much depth. We both like writing in newspapers, and I listened to your lecture at various stages.
actually some Greeks who are now academics in Turkey, and they specialize in the mid-war period. They said one reason why the Greek public in particular went along after those devastating events before that, in less than a decade, was that they still hoped that they could go back to the patrida, to the motherland in Asia Minor. I must check this out, but it makes some sense, because one of the things that I found astounding is that when Kemal didn't come to the draft, but İnönü came at least twice, and there were people in the in the street shouting, supporting him, and flags, Greek and Turkish flags. It has been said that when this was done in Turkey in the 50s or 60s, it was because Turkish people would follow the leader and they would do that. But I mean, for Greeks to do it spontaneously, and they could only do it spontaneously, that might make sense. Now, as to the other periods, the basic reason is Cyprus. I mean, when you have Cyprus, particularly in 1974, then what Karamanlis was doing, the dialogue he initiated, was really very much against the grain. If I remember, it was my master's dissertation at the University College of London, and I looked at school books, but not the Turkish school books, only Greek school books. And then I tried to, at the end, when I published this in a journal, I added another element. I looked at all the speeches of Papandreou as head of the opposition and Karamanlis as the premier, and there was a great difference. I mean, one would come out in a very rushed old way and say that Turkey is not a threat as we additionally considered as a given. They have their views on Cyprus, and the Aegean is not a Greek lake, and we should not act as if it's a Greek lake. This was considered a very, very bold thing to say, and very risky. But that's why I regard Karamanlis, and to some extent Simitis, together with Venizelos and Trikoupis as the four greater states, some reason, But Karamanlis, I think, it was very obvious. I mean, he would come out, and in one of his speeches, he says that we support Greek-Turkish friendship. I mean, imagine Greek-Turkish friendship after 74, you can say that in 76, 77. But Turkey, with its acts, the implying the second invasion, has traumatized that. And now it's the time to come. So it was really, he was an astute statement, while Papandreou was a populist. But I suppose Christos Lirigis would have more to say, whereas you are hiding because I mentioned the name of Papandreou. Now, as regards the other periods,
is this point about great men making history or changing history? And from Karamanlis the Elder, we had comments about the younger Karamanlis totally incompetent. We had the prospects of Samaras playing havoc with Greco-Turkish relations, etc.
Yeah.
It's just this point about the ability of great men to make history or to be led by it.
Yes, that's one thing, but I mean, you can make history if there are a number of factors which are there. For example, one characteristic example was the standard approach from the moment Andreas Papandreou took over, that we do not want Turkey in the European community, European Union. Now, if you look at texts written in the early 90s by esteemed people, the late Ambassador Theodoropoulos, the late Ambassador Junis, Beremis, Koulumbis, and others, in their booklets, sometimes in a more careful manner in the newspapers, they would come up and say, this is counter to Greek interests. If you have a Turkey which will be near to Europe, Turkey will change, the army could not do its thing, it would be put under pressure. And although it was there, they could not change it. And I remember even the very last moment when at the Helsinki meeting, I was chairing an NGO meeting with about 200 people there in a Greek hotel, and I remember until the very last moment, Simitis had misgivings about lifting the veto. And I remember I had a friend of mine who was in George Papandreou's office saying that we're in a difficult position and you people are helpful with your various meetings, NGOs, and so on. Although there were senior politicians there participating, like Kyrgios Dorkos and others, ambassadors like Zepos, Theodoropoulos, and
What approach? Sorry, what?
Anthropo-based approach.
Okay.
So
yeah.
Figures and how they interacted with regard to this conflict. And since you like have studied in detail this conflict, I'm tempted to ask you to give us your narrative again, but this time adopting a Marxist or neo-Marxist approach. So what would the Marxist or neo-Marxist would say about this conflict, and if this like arguments would be plausible?
Well, since I'm not a Marxist or neo-Marxist, I cannot formulate it.
Okay, in terms of economic interest, for example.
Well, could you make the point, and I could see if it makes sense? I mean, it doesn't make sense to me at all. When I tried to use a Marxist model when I did my PhD, which was on ethnic conflict, and found that there was only one theory, which was called internal colonialism, and it comes out from some things said by Gramsci and others, but I mean, a Marxist approach. Could you give some elements of a Marxist approach to make it? Would it be a sort of an economic reductionist approach, or what?
No, I mean,
or would it be? Let me. I'm thinking aloud now. Could it be what has been said from time to time by leftist Turks and Greeks, that this whole conflict is fabricated for the two sides to buy as many weapons as possible? Is that what you had in mind?
No.
Because I was thinking that a more sophisticated Marxist argument. Right.
No. I would like to bring you more to the IPP and talk about the business elites and how the business elites in Turkey have started investing in the Balkans. And the Balkans, as we know, has been also a territory for investment for Greek businesses since the early 90s. And whether you think this might create some kind of conflict in the future.
Well,
it might feed into this perennial nationalism, so whether there are some kind of other interests.
Well, the Greek-Turkish cooperation, be it in further afield or in the Balkans, until now is not conflictual, but the two are going together and helping each other, and there have been. I happen to have a couple of good friends of mine who are businessmen of the first rank, and they have the best of relationships until now. But I suppose this could change, since by definition, in some point, I mean, if they both want to buy a bank or some or minerals or something, and then there could be a clash. But until now, this has gone smoothly. But sorry, I'm not a specialist on that.
Okay, we're not going to get much further with that.
Yes.
In the GSA for 26 years. So what I want to say is I have heard a lot of you, and of course today, you share to mention a lot of times for the conflict between Greece and Turkey. Mm-hmm. What is the conflict? Are there any historical evidence that we had a conflict? And to go further with my argument is that I believe that maybe a conflict could perceive a problem as a conflict. Maybe we had a solution so far. So, who take an advantage of perceive this problem as a conflict? And just to mention that what I believe so far is that the existing variability, especially in grand strategies and national policies, for Greek side, I think that's the major reason for the problems that might we face this day from since 1923, since today.
Well, the conflict exists because there are some outstanding difficulties that have not been resolved.
Maybe this is a tension, maybe this is an event, maybe we had a crisis in 1996.
But there are specific items in the agenda. You see, what happened was in 1973, there were the first lists of outstanding difficulties between the two sides. And the list was more than 15 items on either side. In fact, it was an initiative by Ecevit when he took over power. And his basic argument was the following. Let's try and resolve these differences in the Aegean before they fester, before they really create a difficult situation. Let's try and resolve it. And they presented the Greeks, that was Greek under the Junta, but headed by professional diplomats, fortunately, at the time. And it was a list of something like 15 points, and took about a couple of months for Greece to react. They would, because it realized that this would open up a dialogue, and they want, didn't want a dialogue at that point. And the list at that point did not include even Cyprus. So the various things dealing with minorities, the ecumenical patriarchate, and so on. Look, if we didn't have these deeper reasons for the mutual sense of threat, because it's mutual, it's not only threat on the part of Turkey with regard to Greece, it's the threat of the Turk, although that doesn't make sense in the sense of why is Greece threatening Turkey? It's threatening Turkey because this of the Greek lake thing that I mentioned before. And it goes up to another element, which was discussed by one of you yesterday on the Greek diaspora. I mean, the Greek diaspora in Turkey is regarded as omnipresent, powerful, like the Israeli diaspora, and always able to do damage to Turkey. So there is this thing. And of course, I don't know if you are aware, one of the basic syndromes in Turkey is the Sèvres syndrome, that there's the danger of the country being amputated, being becoming smaller and so on, and that the Greece and the European Union, according to the hardliners in Turkey, has this, that's its hidden agenda, if you want, to amputate and to, you know, to dissolve Turkey, to make it much smaller, as it was in the Sèvres Treaty. Although, of course, obviously this is paranoid. I mean, one should write an article about mutual paranoia in the Greek-Turkish case, to my mind. By the way, I have a number of pilots who were my students, and they were much more realistic and pragmatic as to the Greek-Turkish conflict because they had been there, you know, making all these dogfights than many other colleagues of mine in academia.
I think the question was more about the use of the word conflict.
Yeah.
Rather than other terms.
Yeah. I thought of that. If one does not use the term conflict, they'd use the word dispute, for example, one could get, you know, this thing out of it either and make it more manageable. But what New York, it's good that you raised the point, but I thought that it would be conflict because of all the other paraphernalia which exists and the mutual threat. If it had been relations like between Greece and Italy, for example, that's where they were able to, you know, to delineate the continental shelf, not going to the court, but simply by negotiation. So if it hadn't been for the rest, there would have been simple disputes. But
That's a very good point.
The Turkish state by Kemal and the Greek state, the problems.
That's a very good point.
And stuff like this. And can you see the Lincoln's politics theory coming in that place in explaining the foreign policies of both states? And you also mentioned that they were afraid of revisionist Italy by that time. I read somewhere, I think it was in Costas Karamanlis' PhD thesis.
Yeah, because you know his thesis is on 1930 Venezuela. Yeah.
And he mentioned that actually Mussolini supported Italy supported the Greek Turkish reapproachment effort. This is the first question, and I would like to add something else on that. The Turkish foreign policy of the it's also making an effort of reapproachment of other states like Iran, Iraq. It signs a lot of bargain pacts. Which indicates that the overall foreign policy approach in the area is to be supportive of status quo. The second question, and it's not a political comment, it's that you said that the Kostas Karamanlis government, the former prime minister of Greece, was an incompetent government as far as Greek-Turkish relations is concerned.
I didn't put it very subtly.
But if someone is saying some details, there were bilateral agreements that were signed between Greece and Turkey on that governmental period. There were confidence-building measures that have been extended. There was this notorious energy cooperation
good point. As regards the first, both countries were in need of reconstruction and development at that time, and in the Greek case in particular, and to the Turkish case as well, to some extent, it was the absorption and the integration of this huge number of refugees. So they wanted good relations with the neighbors so they could... So that's a good point, and it's if I sort of rewrite parts of this paper which might appear in an occasional paper, I'll add this element, which is good you raised it. Now, the thing we said about Italy, it is indeed a fact that I think it was a little before 1930, and in the first couple of years, they were supportive of that. On the other hand, Greece and Turkey, after a while, regarded Italy as having, as being sort of revisionist and wanting to dominate the whole. So it was a perception on their part. And both of them, as something that I should have made clear in my text, wanted to align themselves and be allies of Britain. So by definition, when they were with Britain, Italy was against at the time. So I mean, the two were at loggerheads, as it were. Now, the other thing, it's good that you raised, I mean, sometimes it's one thing that one should avoid in PhDs in particular, but, you know, in speeches and so on, one might have to be provocative to raise interesting questions for that matter. It is a fact that if you look at the policy of Kostas Karamanlis, by the way, I'm very critical of Kostas Karamanlis because he had the potential. I mean, Kostas Karamanlis and Andreas Papandreou had a number of qualities, and their potential was much greater than what the outcome, you see. That's why I'm critical of them. Now, Karamanlis, first good point was he tried to decouple the Cyprus issue from the Greek. That was one thing that he did. The second was that he was unequivocal with regard to the Turkey's EU road. I mean, he went against the grain in that regard. All the statistics, opinion polls. Yeah, opinion polls came out with the following result: 80% of the Greeks do not want Turkey to enter the EU. In fact, they're against Greek national interests. You see, it's that kind of tiflosis, as we would say, blindness. So, despite that, Karamanlis was consistent and unwavering as far as this was concerned. Now, my basic criticism comes from the fact that based on the role of Molyviadis, the foreign minister, he had come out with the following. Although the dialogue on the Aegean had already started and they had found a formula to almost resolve it a couple of months before the new government, they said, let's put it on ice. So the talks continued in what were called the exploratory contexts, but the basic approach was we don't want to resolve the conflict, the Aegean dispute now, because the result would be very costly for Greece. It's what I was saying before. Airspace has to go back, I mean, to go to the 6 miles, the continental shelf part of it will have to go to Turkey, and Volyviatis was cognizant of that and was aware that this is, you know, could be very costly in internal politics. So that's why he didn't. By the way, Bakoyani wanted to change things in the first months of her, when she became foreign minister, but because she had the ambition to succeed Kostas Karamanlis, she failed, of course. Alas, she failed, and she was very careful, you see, with regard. Okay.
Desperately short of time.
Oh, sorry.
Could I ask you to ask a really quick question with an equally quick answer?
Yeah, from 54 onwards.
Yeah, but you mentioned also before the 1931.
No, it was looming there far away and could have come out, but it was kept within bounds. That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
Well, if you look, no, I could give you bibliography on that.
Okay. Would you
Yes,
it's a moment.
Yeah.
It's the final plenary session. There's a couple of organisational announcements I need to make, but before then, we need to say some thank yous. We've said thank you to the Ministry for sponsoring part of the event, but I'm sure, as has now been regularly the case, we're very grateful for a number of colleagues who lend us their support, panel chairs from Greece, from the United States. Nikos Zakariadis has just left the room. Christos Lourenzis from Athens. We then have colleagues who are, as it were, old hands, Gerasimos from Sheffield, all the way from Yorkshire. Colleagues within the observatory, like Chris Tsoukis as well. So we depend on their support as panel chairs, those and others, and we thank them. But time is tight, so let me just say Peter as well, I apologize for missing anyone out. Time is tight, but let me say a very genuine and very big thank you to all of those who have been concerned with the organization of the events. And as we finish, I'd like to thank in particular Eleni for being the academic convener, and for Ismini and Ioana, and for Tini, who was here yesterday, for their help. Now, we wanted to say thank you, but also to give a small gift to you as well. So can I just pass these to you? As I pass them to you, the expectation
will not necessarily be alert. Thank you.
Two final things. The final session of the panels is, of course, about to start at 1 o'clock back in the other building. We are giving you plenty of exercise. There will be coffee available in the same room in the other building. But the final thing as a group we would like to do is to invite you all to come out into the foyer immediately outside so we could take a group photograph of this particular symposium. And I think we can then put it on the website and you can see yourself as a group, as it were. So if you would like to join us outside, that would be really good. Thank you.
In the lobby upstairs.
In the lobby upstairs, sorry, the lobby upstairs.